Hello and welcome, listeners and friends, to today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, September 14th, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. I'm your reader, Maddie Ryan, and it looks like on the front page today we have a weather report of partly cloudy, a high of 81, and a low of 52 today. And having a look at the front page headlines, first up, Judge lets Iowa schools require mask. The big feature story is CR advancing $71 million entertainment venue. Next, Iowa sports betting soars with new football season. And the last article on the front page headline reads, Iowa could get first millions from opioid deals next year. And we will jump into the Iowa judge lets schools require mask. State vows appeal over order halting ban passed by Iowa legislature. This comes by the Associated Press. A federal judge ordered Monday that the state of Iowa immediately halt enforcement of a new law that prevents local school boards from ordering masks to be worn in classrooms to help prevent the spread of COVID-19. Judge Robert Pratt said in an order signed Monday that the measure passed in May by Republicans in the Iowa legislature and quickly signed into law by Governor Kim Reynolds, substantially increases the risk of children with existing health conditions of contracting COVID-19. Pratt said he has looked at data on the effectiveness of masks to reduce spread of the virus and agreed with recommendations from the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention and the American Academy of Pediatrics on mask wearing in schools. Because plaintiffs have shown that Iowa Code Section 280.310 ban on masks mandates in schools substantially increases their risk of contracting the virus that causes COVID-19, and that due to their various medical conditions, they are at an increased risk of severe illness or death. Plaintiffs have demonstrated that an irreparable harm exists, he wrote. His order said Reynolds and Iowa Department of Education Director Ann Leob cannot enforce the law that bans locally elected school boards from using their discretion to mandate masks for students, staff, teachers, and visitors inside schools. He issued a temporary restraining order to be in effect immediately. It remains in effect until the court issues an order for a preliminary injunction. Several school districts, including Cedar Rapids, said Monday they were reviewing the order and their options. But the state's largest school system, Des Moines, quickly imposed a mask mandate, according to the Des Moines Register. With today's ruling, as superintendent, I will reinstate a mask mandate, as we had in place for most of last school year, for all students, staff, and visitors to Des Moines Public Schools, Superintendent Tom Arndt said in a statement, the Register reported. 11 parents and the Arc of Iowa, a group that defends the civil rights of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, sued the state September 3rd in the Southern District of Iowa over the law. The plaintiffs are parents of children under 12, kids too young to be eligible for a COVID-19 vaccine. Parental rights. Reynolds said in a statement after the ruling that the judge unilaterally overturned a state law, ignored the discretion by our elected legislature, and took away parents' ability to decide what's best for their child. She said the law will appeal and exercise every legal option we have to uphold state law and defend the rights and liberties afforded to any American citizen protected by our Constitution. Republican Pat Grassley, Speaker of the House, similarly invoked parental rights in a statement. As your elected legislature, we took necessary steps to return decision-maker power to parents. This partisan federal judge's decision strips parents of those freedoms we fought so hard to protect, he said. With an internal link provided in his statement, Grassley noted that Pratt is the same federal judge who apologized after making comments last year to the Associated Press that mocked Republican former President Donald Trump's over his use of pardons. Dangerous ban. In his order, Pratt pointed out that it's been almost 40 years since the U.S. Supreme Court recognized that denying school-aged children a free public education violates the U.S. Constitution. He said the parents in the lawsuit want Iowa school districts to have the opportunity to comply with federal law and ensure that each child receives an education in the least restrictive and the most integrated environment without jeopardizing their lives or safety. Iowa's mask mandate ban makes it not only dangerous for disabled or immunocompromised children to attend school, but several pediatricians opine it is also dangerous for healthy siblings to attend school in person because they risk carrying the virus back to their disabled or immunocompromised siblings, Pratt said. He said the National Pediatrics Academy has recorded about 3,500 new COVID cases among Iowa school-aged children since July, and some public schools in Iowa already are experiencing infection rates at upward of 60% of last year's total for the entire school year. Pratt also points out that the motion by the parents to halt enforcement of the law comes in the heels of the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights, announcing its investigation into whether the mask mandate ban in Iowa and several other Republican-led states violates the Americans with Disabilities Act and Rehabilitation Act by discriminating against school-aged children with disabilities. Funding concerns. Leob has said any district that violates the state law will be referred to the State Board of Education and risk loss of funding. However, the Biden administration announced last week it was establishing a program under which school districts around the nation that went against state laws banning mask mandates could seek emergency federal funding. The parents in the Iowa lawsuit claim that in-person learning is essential and point out that Leob remarked in January 2021 that a return to in-person learning is necessary as students engaged in remote learning are falling behind academically. Parents of these children thus lament the choice of having to either send their children to school in person with the rest of their kids their age without a mask mandate or swallow the lesser option that is not always available to them, remote learning, Pratt said. He continued that the law seems to conflict with the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act, because it excludes disabled children from participating in and denies them the benefit of public schools' programs, services, and activities to which they are entitled. All right, on to the big feature story on the Gazette today, CR advancing $71 million entertainment venue. Pickle Place, Big Grove, potential hotel among use for downtown site. This is from Marissa Pine of the Gazette. A proposal to transform an empty tract of city land once reserved for a casino into Big Grove Brewery, an entertainment center, and outdoor recreation space is moving forward as officials embrace the potential to attract drive-by visitors and locals to what they hope will become a downtown destination. The Cedar Rapids City Council, at its noon meeting today, will consider approving preliminary terms and public financial incentives of a $71 million mixed-use development at First Street and First Avenue West. This land had been earmarked for a casino and related development until regulators twice voted against using a gaming license for a Cedar Rapids venue. Despite market uncertainty amid the pandemic, the 9-member City Council in June 2020 authorized City Manager Jeff Pomerantz and staff to negotiate a term sheet for the project with local developers, First and First West LLC, who said then they were committed to bringing the project to life. The development is advancing to the City Council even though the Iowa Economic Development Authority in June had previously awarded Cedar Rapids only $9 million through its competitive reinvestment district program, $30.5 million less than the city had requested to help fund this and other transformational city projects. The developer has worked really hard to design an innovative space that we think will be very attractive to Cedar Rapids community and to our visitors, Pomerantz said. Interim Economic Development Manager Caleb Mason said the city hired Zach Mannheimer, who founded the non-for-profit Des Moines Social Club, a venue using art, theater, and music to enrich the community, as a consultant to help Cedar Rapids tap into existing assets for the project. How do you make this uniquely Cedar Rapids so that this isn't just any development around any mid-tier market, but build on our strengths? Mason said of Manheimer's assistance. In the last year, Mason said the city and developers have adjusted original design plans, creating a central park element stretching two blocks down the center of the development to enhance use of green space and make a pedestrian walkway. Underneath, there will be stormwater management with underground detention. Mason said the developer will hire a landscape architect to help with consistency of elements, such as lighting that will be part of the outdoor gathering space. Now, parking would be consolidated to one structure. The number of required spaces still is in the works. For an improved pedestrian view of the facility, Mason said one side will potentially include items such as a climbing wall and a large screen to be used for events or on game days. The Second Avenue Southwest side of the development would be lined with 2 to 4 story row house units. Overall, the development could bring 130 residential units plus some owner-occupied condos and townhouses online. It is uncertain what the price points would be on those, Mason said, but that could range from housing costs for people earning 60 to 80% of the area median income to higher-end costs with the condos. On the north block, Mason said, city staff considered how private development interacted with plans for Cedar Rapids recreation with anticipated future construction of a 5-in-1 dam bypass channel, elements of the permanent flood control system, and First Street Southwest. The plan is to realign First Street Southwest away from the river and to raise part of its 14 feet, Mason said. This would help ease traffic flow, but ensure that easy access remains to Interstate 380 to attract people to this new development while connecting it to the river when relocation components are available. We found this to be a win-win that preserves keeping First Street open, and it also creates some interest with the road, Mason said. We'll work on ensuring that there will be some raised medians and plantings and making it an interesting, unique feature with the idea that people will be moving back and forth there. Under the proposed term sheet, the city would provide a 20-year reimbursement at 85% of the tax increments granted for each respective building. The equivalent of at least 250 full-time staff would be employed. This development would be done in 3 phases, starting with 2022 and wrapping up by 2030. In the first phase, a 43,530-square-foot development called Pickle Palace would bring pickleball, rooftop courts, a bar and grill, event space, games, and a third floor roof, deck, and bar. You'll be able to look on either side toward the river or toward the Central Park area and see all the activity that's going on, Mason said. An 8,000 square foot Big Grove Brewery remains in the plans, but it is likely will be in the 2023 when the brewery brings its award-winning India Pale Ale and the rest of its collection of craft beers and other alcoholic beverages to Cedar Rapids. Mason said construction is anticipated to start spring or early 2020 and take about a year. The rest of this phase includes the construction of 2 mixed-use buildings, creating commercial space, and about 72 residential units to be complete by December 2025. The second phase, likely starting June 2023 and ending December 2027, would bring a 4-story residential building with 32 units, a mixed-use building, 8 townhomes, and a city-owned parking ramp. Mason said the parking was part of earlier development plans, which called for a $90 million to $100 million minimum investment, but would now be a separate city project for an estimated $15 million to $20 million. It also may bring a potential 4 or five-story boutique upscale select service or extended stay hotel with about 100 rooms under a brand the city deems acceptable. This would have a dual-sided entrance to spill out to the outdoor area with seating, bag games, and other activities, but also an entrance along First or Second Avenue, Mason said. The third and final phase, with an anticipated June 2024 start and December 2030 completion, would bring a proposed 25,000 to 30,000 square foot entertainment center that could be converted to mixed use, office, or hotel space. Three mixed-use buildings would provide some commercial and residential space. Mason said the final development agreement would come to council later, formalizing the project terms and allowing for some flexibility in use to accommodate potential users. All right, on to sports betting in Iowa. Iowa sports betting scores with new football season. Sports bettors placed $3.5 million a day in August, and that's just the start. This comes from Rod Borscht of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Dateline Des Moines. August was likely the calm before the storm for sports bettors in Iowa. Iowans got a brief taste of college football last month, which helped boost legal sports wagering to $108.42 million, according to data issued Monday by the State Racing and Gambling Commission. But the main course of full-blown betting on college and professional sports this month is expected to generate a new spike in Iowa gambling activities, officials said. We did see a bounce back in the month of August, said Brian O'Hlurk, commission administrator. What's unknown is what we can expect in the fall this year once we have a full slate of activities. There are still many things that are unanswered. It is hard to know where our market will settle. Currently, there are 13 online sports books operating in Iowa, with two more to launch later this month, meaning the market will stay very, very competitive, with customers being lured by a barrage of advertising offering sign-on bonuses and incentives. August represented the first month-over-month gain in betting volume since March, record-setting month that hit $161.44 million in the throes of the college basketball tournament, according to state data. Since July 1st, the sports wagering handle in Iowa stands at $997 million. Features betting and a handful of college games are enough to move the needle. That's how important football is to the sports betting industry, said Eric Ramsey, analyst for the PlayUSA.com network, a website that tracks the Iowa gaming market. August is a precursor for what should be the busiest stretch of the year. Optimistic projections for the last 4 months, but the state passed $1.7 billion in wagers for the year. Last month's $108.4 million sports betting handle followed a brief down period that saw wagering slump to $88.9 million in July, with fewer and lesser popular events available during the summer. Sportsbook in August generated $6.6 million in net receipts from the 21% increase in betting activity, compared with July after paying out $101.8 million in prizes, the commission reported. Most of the sports wagering took place via online apps, where gamblers placed 96.1 million bets in August and $174.5 million so far this fiscal year, which began July 1st. Legalized sports wagering in Iowa generated $965,712 in tax revenue for the state treasury in the current fiscal year. Last marked month 2 full years of legalized sports betting in Iowa, dating to the August 15, 2019 kickoff and the January 1, 2021 expansion to allow online regulations for Iowans age 21 and older. licensed sports books using online apps or in-person options at state-licensed casinos had generated more than $1.8 billion in wagering that produced nearly $130 million in gross gaming revenue and more than $9 million in state tax revenue during the 24 months of operation. Sports bettors placed $3.5 million per day over the 31 days of August, up from $2.9 million per day over the 31 days of July. According to a PlayIowa.com analysis, despite the volume increase, operator revenue fell 14.3% from July, resulting in $486,000 in tax revenue for the state. Year over year, August wagering was up 115% compared with the $50.3 million in August 2020. As slow as the summer months have been, the growth over the last year in Iowa remains remarkable, said Russ Mitchell, lead analyst for PlayIA.com. Nearly $1 billion in 8 months represents a significant jump forward, and that growth should only accelerate over the next 4 months. Iowa's 19 state-licensed casinos saw a slight downturn in adjusted gross revenue for all gambling in August, a $145 million total that brought the year-to-date total for fiscal 2021 to be $302.5 million. Monthly admissions were down slightly with 1,494,619 patrons through the turnstiles, but still recovering from a shutdown period in 2020 caused by the pandemic. State taxes on casino gambling profits approached $53.4 million for the fiscal period that began July 1st. And our last featured article on the front page: Iowa continues first millions from opioid deals next year. Opioid-related deaths increased by 35% in Iowa. This is also by Rod Borscht of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Dateline Des Moines. Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller said Monday he wants financial proceedings from the settlements with opioid manufacturers and distributors named in multi-state lawsuits to be directed towards treatment, recovery, and abasement efforts to address addictions that claimed at least 213 lives in Iowa last year. My goal has always been to use this additional money in the best possible way to deal with this enormous crisis epidemic that has harmed so many people and was totally unnecessary, Miller said in an interview. Miller was actively involved in several settlements reached in the recent months, including a $26 billion agreement with three major opioid distributors, Cardinal, McKesson, and AmerisourceBergen, and Johnson & Johnson, which manufactured and marketed opioids, and a $4.3 billion settlement with the Sackler family and their opioid Purdue Pharma that will generate money to help bring relief to people across the country struggling with opioid addiction. While there are still areas of complex agreements to be finalized, the Iowa Attorney General said he believes things are proceeding to a stage where Iowa will begin receiving $15 to $20 million initially sometime in 2022 as part of a multi-year effort to abate an opioid crisis the defendant drug companies helped create in Iowa and across the nation with false and deceptive claims and marketing. There are still a lot of things to be done, but it's hopefully crossing the Rubicon, he said. To that end, Miller and his office has been working with officials in the State Department of Public Health, counties, the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, and others to begin shaping a strategy to identify the addictions Iowans are dealing with and tailor ways to treat complex features of the opioid crisis. While recognizing that the lawsuit proceeds won't come close to meeting the needs of Iowans trying to overcome addictions to prescription drugs, heroin, or fentanyl, one of the things we could do with the money is just find out as best we can the degree and the source and the type of addiction in Iowa. That's something that I would advocate, he said. Miller noted that the settlement agreements provide that the proceeds have to be used for abatement purposes. Initially, he said, a national administrator will sign off on the settlement money and make sure the planned use by the Iowa officials fits within the intended uses. We want to make sure that the benefits from the additional money are spread out throughout the state, that everybody in the state has a chance to benefit from this, the attorney general said. We hope that this can be a model for dealing with an addiction. Opioid-related deaths increased by 35% in Iowa in 2020, following a national trend that has advocates raising the alarm about the surge. State officials reported 213 opioid-related deaths last year, up from the 157 deaths reported in 2019, and a previous high of 206 in 2017. Miller said his office is negotiating with the state public health officials and Iowa County attorneys on how to proceed with the settlement money. Discussions have also taken place with UIHC officials to use up to $3.5 million for training using telemedicine for doctors, nurses, practitioners, and physicians' assistants that focuses on federally approved medication-assisted treatment and contracting on complex issues. We believe that there are a number of people who could quit completely through treatment, and that's the optimum, that's what we want, Miller said. But we think there are many others who can't, and we think the medication assistance treatment is a very viable alternative, and we're going to work towards that. And more Cedar Rapids news here. Hoeiger seeks second term on CRD Council. He was elected in 2017 to District 1 seat. This comes from Marissa Pine of the Gazette. Marty Hoeiger is seeking a second term representing Cedar Rapids City Council District 1. Hoeiger, the owner of building materials supplier Ogden & Adams, filed nomination papers last week to be on the November 2nd ballot. Hoeiger, 49, is the only one to file papers for the District 1 seat, which covers much of the northeast Cedar Rapids and a small portion of the northwest quadrant closest to the Cedar River. He was first elected in 2017 with 1,777 votes, nearly 53% of ballots cast in that race. Hoeiger said there remains much work to be done and he wants to see it through. In particular, he identified activities locating funding for flood protection for the west side of the city, which the federal government does not cover. Hoeiger said the recovery from the 2020 derecho with tree cleanup and building repairs, as well as recovery from the economic impacts of COVID-19, were top priorities. I just feel like I didn't get in this for a four-year stint to get in and get out, Hoeiger told the Gazette about his decision to seek a second term. There's a lot of work to do, so I'm running for another 4 years to keep working on it. Hoeiger has spent his career working in real estate and development, having held roles as the City Real Estate Development Coordinator, as Executive Director of the Neighborhood Development Corps, and as the Business Development Manager for Graham Construction. On the council, Hoeiger is a member of the Development Committee and Flood Control System Committee. He serves the community on the boards of the CR Network, St. Luke's Foundation, Neighborhood Development Corps, Downtown SSMID, and the I Know Jack Foundation. Council members are paid $19,420.70 annually to serve in the part-time roles. Their terms begin at noon, January 1st, 2022, for the five seats on the ballot. You are listening to a reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. All materials read on IRIS are intended solely for the use of the blind and print handicapped. We will now turn over to today's obituaries. Darlene M. Shute, Darlene M. Shute, 91, a longtime resident of the Hills area, died peacefully Saturday, September 11th, 2021, at Mercy Hospital. Massive Christian burial will be celebrated at 10 a.m. Friday, September 17th, at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Hills. Burial will follow at St. Silicent's Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday on the lawn next to St. Joseph's Catholic Church, where a rosary will be recited at 3:30 p.m. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Camp Courageous, Reach for Your Potential, or Iowa City Hospice. Due to the pandemic, masks will be available. Darlene was born June 8, 1930, the daughter of James and Ella Buline. She was raised on the family farm south of Lone Tree and was a 1949 graduate of Lone Tree High School. Darlene was united in marriage to John Bud Shute on August 20, 1949, at St. Mary's Church in Lone Tree. Darlene was a member of St. Joseph's Church, St. Joseph Altar and Rosary Society, the Hills Red Ruby Hat Club, and the Hills Town and Country Club. She was a volunteer at Atrium Village and for many years was a 4-H leader. Darlene loved to work in the field with her husband. She enjoyed her vegetable and flower gardens and time spent canning the produce from her garden. She made quilts for grandchildren and sewed many baby-receiving blankets for families and friends. Being a farm wife, mom, and grandma was the joy of her life. You were always welcome in her kitchen, where you could find a good meal and homemade pie and cookies. Darlene treasured the time with her family and was ready at any moment's notice to jump in the car and attend children and grandchildren's activities or babysit if needed. She enjoyed traveling and taking trips with the Hills Bank Friends Club. Jeffrey T. Betzer from Cedar Rapids. Jeffrey T. Betzer, 52, passed away September 7, 2021, in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Jeff was a longtime employee of Metzik Machinery in Cedar Rapids. He is survived by his wife, Josie Ashmore, son Samuel Ashmore Betzer, daughter Jessanne Kelman in Texas, and mother Charlene Baker, father Todd Betzer, sister Jennifer Zachor, brother Terry Merritt, and aunts and uncles, cousins, in-laws, and many friends and co-workers. Jeff was born May 8, 1969 in Cedar Rapids, where he grew up and went to school. Jeff had a great, fun-loving personality. He liked jokes and pranks. He was a music lover, though he could not sing. Collecting and playing vinyl albums and enjoying numerous stereo systems in his home, often played loudly. He was an auto racing enthusiast, enjoyed watching NASCAR and sprint car racing. He had a love of farming since childhood and cherished the time spent at his Grandpa Beatty's farm in Cogan, Iowa, and helping his father-in-law at the family farm in Bloomfield, Iowa. He was a hard worker, enjoying and proud of his work at Metzke and sometimes working two jobs throughout the years. He loved his big dog Cooper, who has passed, and his current dog Pablo and all the animals. He was a loving father. Jeff will be greatly missed by everyone. Private services will be held at a later date. From Cedar Rapids, J. Susan Mattson, 72, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, died Saturday, September 11th, 2021, at the Dennison and Donna Alford Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha, Iowa. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, September 7th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A funeral service will take place at 2:30 p.m. Saturday, September 18th, at the funeral home. The family requests casual dress and be comfortable like Susan would want you to be. Burial will follow at Campbell Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Susan was born July 16, 1949, in Williamsburg, Iowa, the daughter of Ralph and Glenna Blair. On October 8, 1965, she was united in marriage to Carl Mattson in Jefferson City, Missouri. Susan worked in housekeeping at St. Luke's Hospital and then in customer service at Casey's General Store until her retirement in 2019. She enjoyed going to the casino and going shopping. Susan loved scratch tickets, her cats, and meeting new people. Everyone she met was her friend. Memorials may be directed to the family. A memorial fund has been established at Lynn Area Credit Union. From Central City, Irma Jean Van Alst, 84, of Central City, Iowa, passed away Sunday, September 12, 2021, at Dennis and Donna Alford Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha, Iowa. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m., Wednesday, September 16th, at CRF First Assembly Church, located at 3233 Blairis Ferry Road, Northeast, in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, with Pastor Rick Gale officiating. The family will greet friends and family from 9 a.m. until the service time Wednesday at the church. Please enter through door number 3 or door number 4 at the church for the visitation and the service. In agreement with her wishes, cremation will take place after the service. A private family committal service will take place at a later date. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, Iowa is assisting the family. Irma Jean was born January 3, 1937, in Central City, one of three children to Leonard and Fern Iola Makins. She was a 1955 graduate of Central City High School. On January 18, 1992, Irma Jean was united in marriage to Alva Eugene Van Alst. She was a switchboard telephone operator for the Central City Telephone Company and also worked for the Sutton family at the Lynn County Newsletter. Irma Jean was employed for several years as a secretary for the Lynn County Conservation Parks and Recreation Department. She was a member of First Assembly Church. Irma Jean loved reading the Bible and sharing scriptures with family and friends. She will be greatly missed by all who knew and loved her. In lieu of flowers, memorials in Irma Jean's memory may be made to CR First Assembly Church or the family to be designated at a later date. Bonnie L. McCoy from Cedar Rapids. Bonnie L. McCoy, 89, of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, September 8, 2021, at St. Luke's Hospital. Services are pending with Borch Chapel and the Avocturn in Cedar Rapids. She donated her body to the University of Iowa deeded program. Bonnie was born July 10, 1932, in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Earl Burt and Doris Sarah McCready. She graduated from Franklin High School in 1951 and married Roland Lee in 1952. They were married for 23 years. During this time, she worked as an office assistant to Cedar Rapids' Doctor of Psychiatry. Bonnie was united in marriage to Walter McCoy in 1982. Upon retirement, Bonnie enjoyed working as a counselor and manager for the Diet Center. In her leisure time, she and her husband Wally spent many years together on the Cedar River at Ellis Harbor. Bonnie was a strong Christian and instilled her beliefs on her family. She enjoyed watching the Hawkeyes and spending precious time with her loving family. Memorials may be directed to Uni Point Hospital in her name. From Cedar Rapids, Araflontalis Maurice Royce, known as Justin by his family, 37, of Cedar Rapids, passed away suddenly Sunday, September 12, 2021, at his home. Services, 1 p.m. Saturday at Tien Funeral Home by Deacon John Winkle. Burial, St. Joseph's Cemetery. Friends may visit the family from noon to 1 Saturday at the funeral home. Justin is survived by his father, Daryl Keller of Cedar Rapids, sister Patricia Keller Petre of Las Vegas, Nevada, partner for life, Deanna Strode of Cedar Rapids, special aunt Barbara Moll of St. Peter's, Missouri, nieces and nephews, John Schuyler, Mackenzie, Kaylee, Emily, Natalie, uncles, Eldon, Carol, Johnny, and Richard, aunts Nancy, Sylvia, Doris, and Karen, best friend Don Brierly, and many cousins. He was preceded in death by his mother and his maternal and paternal grandparents. Justin was born October 28, 1983, in Cedar Rapids to Daryl and Mary Bargan Keller. He graduated from Jefferson High School in 2001. Justin had a heart and always told people that he loved them. He was willing to help people whenever he was needed. Justin was an avid Iowa Hawkeye and Tampa Bay Buccaneers fan. He loved his cats, Pumpkin and Sweet Pea. Memorials may be directed to the family. From Oxford Junction, Mary Ruth Lassick, 90, of Oxford Junction, passed away Friday, September 10th, 2021, at home. Her funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, September 25th, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Oxford Junction, with a visitation prior to her service from 9 to 10:15 a.m. Burial will be held at Mayflower Cemetery in Oxford Junction. Dawson Funeral Services of Oxford Junction is caring for her family. Mary was born April 17, 1931, in Maquoketa to Clarence and Viola Cook. Mary graduated from Delmar High School, then attended St. Ambrose School of Nursing to earn her certificate in nursing. On March 2, 1957, she was united in marriage to the love of her life, Paul Lassick, at St. Paul Catholic Church in Delmar. After marriage, she helped on the farm while raising their 9 children. Mary and Paul were known for attending many sports events, musical programs, and other school events for their children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Her vocal encouragement could always be heard above the crowd. They watched and attended many St. Louis Cardinals baseball games. Mary was an avid volunteer, serving many funeral dinners, teaching religious education, chauffeuring for ball games, and working in many lunch stands and 4-H events. She was known for her huge family dinners, complete with multiple pies and collages. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Oxford Junction, Oxford Junction Fire, or Oxford Junction Ambulance. And that concludes all of our obituaries in the paper today. Why don't we have a peek at an opinion or two? All right, this is a community letter. Columnist Sullivan is wrong about ethanol politics. Just as we know, it won't be long before Iowa weather changes. We can always count on it to be long before Adam Sullivan writes his next column against ethanol. Most recently, he criticized Iowa Democrats for calling out Ted Cruz while he was in the state recently or relentlessly working against the success of Iowa biofuels. He chalked up the party's support for ethanol as political and cynical, but Sullivan couldn't be more wrong. It is cynical to stand up for a key sector of Iowa's economy that supports nearly 40,000 jobs and contributes billions to the state's GDP. Is it playing politics to point out that Cruz is preparing the nation's most well-known adversary against the growth of biofuels? Sullivan's assertion that Iowa Democrats have only recently started supporting ethanol in recognition to former President Donald Trump's stance on the issue is just silly. Former Senator Tom Harkin and former Representatives Leonard Boswell and David Loebsack would be shocked to hear such an assertion. A recent Harvard University study found ethanol reduces greenhouse gas emissions by nearly 50% compared with gasoline. Iowa biofuels are getting cleaner with each passing year, and Iowa's leader across party lines see that. Iowa's leaders see, as Senator Chuck Grassley likes to say, ethanol is good, good, good. The only one being cynical and playing politics here is Mr. Sullivan, and it's just wrong, wrong, wrong. That comes from Cassidy Walter, Communications Director at Iowa Renewable Fuels Association. From the At Liberty opinion section, we have Adam Sullivan and his opinion, parole won't solve Iowa's prison crisis. If Iowa were its own country, it would have the second highest incarceration rate in the world, ahead of every county on the planet besides the United States itself. Like Iowa, most U.S. states incarcerate a higher portion of residents than all foreign countries, according to a report published this month by Prison Policy Initiative. It's not because Americans are innately more criminal than citizens of other countries. It's because we have a lot of jail cells and we feel the need to fill them. Iowa's incarceration rate of 582 per 100,000, slightly below the national average of 664, ranks just above El Salvador, which is considered one of the most dangerous countries in the world. The Central American nation's homicide rate is nearly 10 times higher than Iowa's. Iowa's policymakers have at least paid lip service in recent years to the idea of shrinking the prison population, but they have not made such progress. The number of state prison inmates dipped to a 20-year low last year, attributable to pandemic-related releases and diversions, but the number has crept back up since. As of this month, the state prison system is 12% over capacity with about 7,800 inmates. Some county jails are also near or at their capacity. The chairman of the Iowa Parole Board has a goal to get the prisoners within capacity in the next 2 years, the Gazette Rod Borscht reported last month. The board accelerated releases at the height of the pandemic, but releases plummeted to at least a 15-year low last fiscal year. Now, as things inch back up because the gates are now opening from the jails back into the prisons, and the numbers are climbing up, we've just got to find new ways to be aggressive and think outside the box to both promote release, but we've got to keep the community safe at the same time, said Andrew Boddicker, an Ames lawyer appointed this year as chairman of the Iowa Parole Board. Letting people out of prison is a good thing, but keeping them out may prove more difficult. John Neff, a local scholar who studies incarceration, compared figures from the Prisons and Community Corrections Program and found prison vacancies often are filled by probation revocations. What I think will happen is the Board of Parole will empty the beds and the district court judges will fill them by revocations of probation, Neff wrote in a report letter to the editor. In other words, prison beds in Iowa don't tend to stay empty for long. The system will find someone to fill them. With an incarceration crisis, the magnitude of Iowa's no-parole strategy alone will be adequate to bring us back in line with global norms. Over several decades, states and federal governments have built giant crime-fighting machines. Police departments with powerful unions and never-ending budget increases, multi-jurisdictional task forces to federalize what should be routine local enforcement, a vast network of jails and prisons. That system, it turns out, doesn't do much to prevent crime. It may actually exacerbate the underlying issues that lead to crime. When all you have is a jail cell, everybody looks like a prisoner. And now some sports news from Northern Iowa football. Panthers rediscover their rushing attack by Cole Brer, a correspondent in Cedar Falls. After a 27-point outburst in the third quarter of Saturday night's win at Sacramento State, led by backup quarterback Theo Day, Northern Iowa football coach Mark Farley wasn't ready to announce Monday who's this week's starter will be. As I sit here right now on the depth chart, it's saying either or. I think it's obvious Theo had a great game. I'll make that final choice here before we go to practice Tuesday, Farley said. I was very pleased with Theo's demeanor and how prepared he was for the game. He had a calm approach to what he was doing. He landed the hurdle well. All those things were the things you would not have known unless you got him in a game situation. Despite the non-announcement, Farley's cascade of compliments for Day seems to indicate the Michigan State transfer will be under center for the Panthers' home opener Saturday against St. Thomas, who has a record of 1-0. While Day stole the headlines in the 34-16 win against the Hornets, UNI's running game had its first 200-plus yard effort since a 38-7 defeat of Western Illinois on November 23rd in 2019. Starter Dom Williams led the way with 97 yards on 16 carries. Vance McShane and Bradrick Shaw racked up 65 and 38 yards, respectively, while the group climbed for 52 5.2 yards per carry. Asked about their performance Monday, Farley acknowledged a scheme change under offensive coordinator Sean Watson and the influx of transfer at the position, Williams, McShane, and Shaw were key to Saturday night's breakthrough. The scheme is different. We've been ramping up towards this. I do think the things that we did in the offseason made a big difference, Farley said. You got our four tailbacks that can alternate in there so you can be fresh. You can do some things because you're not worried about getting nicked up for the next game because you have quality and depth. Saturday's win wasn't without an equally impressive performance by UNI's defense. The unit produced 6 takeaways, 3 interceptions, and 3 fumbles, and middle linebacker Spencer Colvier was recognized as the Stars Performer FCS National Defensive Player of the Week after a 15-tackle performance with 2 of the Panthers' forced tumbles and 1 of the recoveries. We don't have complete control, and we got out of situations because of turnovers. We made great plays, Farley said. The turnovers kept us in the game in the first half. In the second half, when everything ignited with the excitement and everything that happened, then our 4 turnovers took hold because we were getting good field position for the offense. Ahead of Saturday's home opener against St. Thomas, wide receiver Logan Wolfe, hamstring remains questionable, while offensive lineman Matthew Vanderslice, undisclosed, is probable. UNI, with a record of 1-1, kicks off against the Tommies at 4 p.m. Saturday on channel ESPN3.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, the Food and Drug Administration has announced 2 drug recalls this week. Sandoz is pulling all of its prescription ranitidine capsules because testing detected a suspected carcinogen called NDMA. Health authorities in Canada, much of Europe, and Taiwan have already issued recalls for Zantac and generic ranitidine. The FDA has not yet asked other U.S. distributors to pull their ranitidine products. Ranitidine is an H2 antagonist used to treat ulcers and acid reflux. In addition, Torrent Pharmaceuticals is recalling multiple lots of the blood pressure drug Losartan. This action is related to detection of the impurity NMBA. This nitrosamine compound is also a probable human carcinogen. Torrent has now recalled more than 300 lots of blood pressure medicines during the past year.
Aspirin has been getting mixed reviews lately. Earlier this year, the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology said that low-dose aspirin should only be used by older people at high risk of strokes or heart attacks. Others, they said, would be more likely to be harmed. Now, though, researchers from Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center report that patients with head and neck cancer have a better chance of survival if they take low-dose aspirin while undergoing treatment. An additional 8% of patients taking the 81 milligram daily dose were still alive 5 years after treatment compared to those not taking aspirin. A different study at Roswell Park compared aspirin versus no aspirin among 164 patients being treated for early stage non-small cell lung cancer. The patients got precision radiation therapy. 2 years after treatment, 57% of those taking low-dose aspirin were still alive compared to 48% of those who did not take the drug. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has also recommended that obstetricians consider recommending low-dose aspirin to patients at risk of preeclampsia. This complication of pregnancy can be extremely serious for both mother and baby. Women taking low-dose aspirin are 24% less likely to develop preeclampsia.
Scientists suggest that the Puerto Rican culinary tradition of incorporating sofrito into many dishes might help explain a lower rate of breast cancer there. This condiment is made with onions, garlic, peppers, cilantro, and a related herb, rucao. Epidemiologists found that Puerto Rican women who ate lots of garlic and onions, including sofrito, were 67% less likely to get breast cancer than those who never ate sofrito. The total intake of onions and garlic was important, not only the use of sofrito. The researchers point out that onions and garlic are rich in flavanols and sulfur-containing compounds that have anti-cancer activity.
Despite lots of information about how to eat healthfully, Americans are still getting too much of their energy from low-quality carbohydrates. Nutrition scientists drew this conclusion from analyzing nutrition health and examination survey data from 1999 to 2016. Although the American diet got a little better over that time frame, the change was modest. Only 9% of calories in a typical American diet come from whole fruits and whole grains. About 42% comes from highly refined grains, added sugar, and starchy vegetables such as potatoes. The estimated healthy eating index went from 55.7 to 57.7. Although this change is statistically significant, it leaves plenty of room for improvement.
Americans are often exhorted to walk on the sunny side or look for the silver lining. Can such a cheery attitude influence your health? A recent meta-analysis in JAMA Network Open suggests that optimistic individuals are less likely to suffer heart attacks, strokes, angina, and death from cardiovascular causes. The analysis included 15 studies with a total of more than 200,000 participants. A pessimistic attitude increased people's risk of cardiac problems. The author suggests that health professionals might want to come up with interventions to reduce pessimism and promote optimism, especially in cardiac rehab programs. They express the hope that their study might stimulate research into the heart benefits of a sense of purpose or gratitude. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.